It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For a half century, the Association of Pittsburgh Priests has been an outspoken voice for the Catholic Church in Pittsburgh. But they've been doing so without the blessing of, and at times in opposition to, leaders of the diocese. It's a relationship that's long fascinated our next guest. Art McDonald came back to Pittsburgh recently to launch his new book, A Progressive Voice in the Catholic Church in the United States. Art, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin.
You lived in Pittsburgh for about 20 years, from the early 80s to the early 2000s. How did you become interested in the Association of Pittsburgh Priests?
So, you know, in thinking about this, Kevin, I realized in writing this book, other than having these great relationships with many of the members of the association, it's a little bit my story as well. I was ordained a Catholic priest in the 1970s with the Dominican Religious Order and worked in New York City for many years before I came to Pittsburgh. So I've always had a real interest in ministry, and particularly Catholic ministry, but beyond that as well. So it was natural for my wife and myself, when we came to Pittsburgh, to link up with this group and to support their work for a better world.
So you got to know them because you were a priest, and then eventually you left the priesthood.
Yeah, and we came to Pittsburgh. I actually took a job at the Thomas Merton Center right around the corner on East Carson Street in 1982. And the Thomas Merton Center, actually, the Association of Pittsburgh Priests was instrumental in founding the Thomas Merton Center. They were the initial funders of the group. So there was this link between the Merton Center and the APP, which I benefited from.
The group was formed in 1966. There was already an official clergy council within the diocese. Why did the founders of the association feel that this group was necessary?
So the founders felt that they wanted to have their own independent voice, and that the official clergy council was too much a spokesperson for the diocese and for the bishop. And the association always had this notion, we wanted to work closely with the official council and with the bishop, but we also wanted to be able to speak with our own voice when we thought it necessary.
And did you feel that things were not progressing the way you liked, and that's why you left the priesthood, or were there other reasons?
Oh, in my own personal case, I think it was multifaceted. Certainly, the issue of mandatory celibacy was always on the agenda. And if you read anything about the Association of Pittsburgh Priests, it's one of the many issues that they constantly raise about optional celibacy versus mandatory. So that was certainly, for many of us in the ministry, a struggle in the Catholic world. But also, as I was working in the Bronx, there was a major change going on in the Catholic Church at the time. Pope Paul VI, who was implementing Vatican II, died in 1978.
And a reminder, Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council. For our listeners, that meeting was from 62 into 65, and it discussed and promoted changes in how Catholics worship and govern themselves, and it set the stage for a lot of conversations we're still having about reform today.
Exactly right. It was a real reform council, and cautiously, Pope Paul VI was working on reform. After he died, and Pope John Paul II was elected in 1978. By 1982, when I left the ministry, it was getting clear that the windows were starting to come down, starting to close down from Vatican II, and that this new pope had a very different vision and actually maybe had some hesitation and doubts about the reforms.
The windows for internal reform within the church structure?
Correct. That's
okay.
Right.
You write that the group, the Association of Pittsburgh Priests, remained loyal to the church and local leadership. So how did they push the envelope? What have they been doing that the diocese didn't or won't?
So the APP was mostly interested in open dialogue. And so there were church teachings that the APP wanted to have some discussions about. For example, married priesthood, optional celibacy, the role of women in the church, maybe women deacons, and eventually women's ordination, as some of the internal issues of the church. But they also had an issue with the diocese not fully implementing the social teachings of the Catholic Church.
So outward looking, I guess.
Outward looking as well. Issues of war and peace, economic inequality, and such. And so they tried to open channels of dialogue around internal church issues and also implementing the church's social teaching. And one of the issues over the years that the APP has always been very strong on is, although they're very much in keeping with the church teaching around abortion and seeing abortion as not a valid option for people and certainly a moral evil on many levels, they also realize that many women are in situations where they have to make difficult decisions. And the APP wanted to open a dialogue about how people could discuss differences and that faithful Catholics maybe could be pro-choice, anti-abortion, but pro-choice. And the APP always had a very, very difficult time that the church focused often solely on the issue of abortion and not other social issues.
Were there similar groups in other cities that were not authorized, sanctioned by their dioceses?
There were, Kevin. I didn't fully document all of them. I would say in the later part of the 1960s, maybe half a dozen independent priest groups. But as time went on, I would say it was Chicago and Pittsburgh that were the prominent independent priest groups.
I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest on The Confluence is Art McDonald, who has written a book about the Association of Pittsburgh Priests and their progressive voice within the church over the last 50 years. So what's the state of the group today? About how many of local priests are members of the group?
So as you can well imagine, the numbers have dwindled from the early years. I think at one point, maybe in the late 60s, mid 70s, they said they had 80, 85 members, official members. There were always lots of priests, Kevin, who supported APP, sent them dues money, but didn't want their name associated with the group.
The numbers dwindled just because of age or just disinterest?
Well, the numbers dwindled because many reasons. One, of course, many have died, and many others have aged out. Mm-hmm. But also, the last priest, canonical priest, to join association was 1979.
So the association also includes men who have left the priesthood, as well as, I believe, women. How have the bishops reacted to that?
Not well. It was just consistent with their reaction to APP in general. But in 1992, as you suggest, they were approached, the APP, by the wife of a former priest, a former member of APP, asking to join the group, and could you open up membership, which they discerned after a six-month discernment period, decided to open their membership to all baptized Catholics.
Have the goals of this group changed over the decades, whether it's regarding how the church should respond to worldly issues, whether it's poverty, social injustice, the environment?
I would say their goals have been incredibly consistent, Kevin. You know, they started out saying we're about, number one, church renewal in light of Vatican II, number two, social justice and the church's social teachings, and solidarity and support among one another. And I think those goals are still in place.
And the internal changes, does the association put out an official stance whether they support married priests, women deacons, and even women priests?
Yeah, all the time they talk about that. Yeah, it's still very much part of their agenda.
But it doesn't go anywhere.
Well, you know, that's not totally true in
all
the
right.
moment. In fact, there was a conference in Rome within the last month and a half of the Amazon bishops, which was mostly Brazil, but not totally. And at the end of that conference, they voted, those bishops, 2-1 to get permission to ordain married priests and also to ordain women deacons. So right now, Francis has that on his desk, and he has to decide what to do about it.
Locally, what do they want from our current bishop, David Zubik, regarding internal changes, external changes?
So as you can well imagine, the clergy sexual abuse crisis and the grand jury report in 2018 has really altered the dialogue in many, many ways. Preceding that, the year preceding that, the APP actually was in a very interesting dialogue with the diocese, and they were getting positive feedback from the diocese as maybe being an aid to their work for social justice. So there were several meetings that happened. There was even talk about APP representing the diocese and parishes around social teachings and so forth. And then the grand jury report came out and all bets were off. I think the diocese, as I see it and people here tell me, has been scrambling ever since, you know, and trying to respond to what was a devastating, devastating public report. So what's happened in the last year is that APP continues to dialogue with the bishop, but a whole new group of lay leaders, Catholic leaders, has emerged. The acronym is CCOC, Catholic Church for Change. and I'm missing one of the words.
Yes,
but
they've been on our show.
They've been on your show. Yes. Kevin Hayes is one of the key leaders. And APP and CCOC are working very closely. CCOC has set up any number of listening sessions with the bishop, and they're currently going on as we speak. Where that dialogue is going, I'm not sure. I think some of my APP folks feel that the bishop, the current bishop, is very, very good at listening and very, very patient with the dialogue, but they have not seen any action or any hardcore response to what they're asking. Among other things, lay leadership, empowerment of lay people, serious dialogue about women in ministry, about married priesthood and so forth. They're not seeing any movement on that.
Finally, what are you expecting as somebody who's intimately close with the priesthood, knowing a lot of these priests? What are you expecting versus what are you hoping for as a result of Pope Francis' tenure?
So my hope is that by the time Francis moves on, whether it's through death or, I think, even more likely, retirement, now that that precedent has been set by Pope Benedict.
Yeah.
I think the best hope, and this, I believe, is Francis' strategy, is that by the time he moves on, he has laid the groundwork for regional churches to be empowered to make decisions. So as we move forward in continuing to implement Vatican II, which Francis has always said is a 100-year process, and we're in year 54, I believe, 46 years ago. But the hope is that he's laid the groundwork for regional empowerment so that those areas of the country, Latin America, Asia possibly, even parts of Europe, would move ahead with church reform and other churches, maybe the United States Church, which is, I think, a fairly conservative group of leadership still, maybe slow to change. But you may see change in other parts of the world. And I think that would be the Francis effect here, to decentralize Vatican power and to empower regional leadership.
Art MacDonald is the author of A Progressive Voice in the Catholic Church in the United States, Association of Pittsburgh Priests, 1966 to 2019. Thanks so much for joining us.
Kevin, it's been a pleasure, and thanks for inviting me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
When it's live, anything could happen. Elvis Costello put a bit of that anything goes energy into his Saturday Night Live debut on this day in 1977. The English singer and songwriter filled in for his countrymen, the Sex Pistols, after they were denied entry into the U.S. He was already here, touring behind his debut album, My Aim Is True. Costello was supposed to play the single Less Than Zero, but ended it abruptly, saying it was pointless to sing about a British politician that nobody knew about. He launched into the yet-to-be-released Radio Radio and earned himself a band that lasted until 1989. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Most banks won't work with the marijuana industry, even in states including Pennsylvania, that have legalized the drug for medical use. That's because marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, and banks that work with cannabis businesses could be liable for money laundering. 90.5 WESA's Onley Herring reports there are banks that serve the industry, but it's often at a high cost and with limited benefits.
Pittsburgh attorney Katya Kosofsky remembers it like it was yesterday.
I don't think I'll ever forget that day.
It was January of 2018, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced he would let prosecutors crack down on the medical marijuana industry.
And I remember specifically looking at that and saying, what's going to happen next? And nobody really knew.
Kosofsky, who represents marijuana growers and dispensaries, says nothing ever came of Sessions' announcement, but it was a bitter reminder of the risks that come with doing business in a legal gray area. Kosofsky says the stakes are high when it comes to banking.
We're talking about generating hundreds of thousands of dollars on a regular basis. And if you don't have where to put it, you become a target for criminal activity.
A few banks have opened their vaults to Pennsylvania's cannabis providers. But Rebecca Myers of the marijuana grower Pharmaceutical RX in Mercer County says the service comes with steep fees unheard of in other industries.
We're probably, with our different accounts, spending close to, $100,000 a year
Other medical marijuana businesses in western Pennsylvania say they also pay about $3,000 a month for each of their accounts. And these costs, Meyer says, often get passed on to customers. Pharmaceutical RX uses New Jersey-based Park Bank, as do many other local cannabis suppliers. They say Park was the only option they found when they set up shop in Pennsylvania. Park didn't respond to a request for comment, but it's likely the high fees are due to the cost of compliance. The U.S. Treasury, for example, requires banks to file what are called suspicious activity reports as a way to avoid prosecution.
We have to take a look and say, hey, does the money coming in make sense?
That's Dan Moon, the president and CEO of SSB Bank, a community bank based in McCandless.
This may get locked up in the vault tonight because it'll take a while to count it all by hand, okay?
Yeah. A teller pulls stacks of cash across the counter. When medical marijuana dispensary Keystone Integrated Care makes a deposit, it involves a lot of hard cash. Most banks and credit card companies bar transactions with the cannabis industry, so patients use cash. In its reports to the Treasury Department, SSB has to account for all deposits and withdrawals Keystone makes, says CEO Dan Moon.
The money comes in, they pay out vendors, they pay salaries, they pay overhead or mortgages, and what's left, does it match the profit?
Moon says if something doesn't seem right, his bank has to report it as a red flag, which could suggest a cannabis business is operating as a front for criminal activity. Keystone is SSB's lone medical marijuana client, and unlike other banks, SSB doesn't charge Keystone any extra fees. Moon says that wouldn't fit the model of a community bank like his, and he says Keystone helps SSB by boosting its liquidity.
So it's like a two-way street. They bring in their money and their revenues, and we're able to lend it back out to the community.
Yet Keystone's John Schaefer notes that companies like his generally can't borrow from banks. The banks don't want to take that legal risk. So instead, Schaefer says, marijuana businesses are funded by numerous investors. And he says that was one of the hardest parts of getting Keystone off the ground.
You're going out and meeting with people. You're incurring a lot of legal costs. It's a lot more intensive to raise the capital.
And private shareholders typically demand returns on investment that are much higher than interest rates charged at banks. The marijuana industry has made such challenges known to lawmakers and hopes legislation in Congress will provide relief. The House of Representatives passed the bipartisan Safe Banking Act in September, but it's not expected to get a vote in the Senate anytime soon. Anlie Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
Check out a series of stories on medical marijuana in Pennsylvania online at WESA.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Trump administration has finalized the first of three controversial policies that will limit eligibility for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, or SNAP benefits. Joining us to discuss how these policies could impact folks locally is Ken Riegel. He's the executive director of the Southside-based anti-hunger group Just Harvest. Ken, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
The new rule surrounds an already in place 3-month time limit for receiving benefits within a 3-year period. The change is that states have less authority to waive the SNAP time limit in areas with high unemployment rates. Has Pennsylvania historically waived the time limit?
Yes. For most of the 20 years or so that this rule has been in effect at the federal level, Pennsylvania has waived most of the state out of these requirements. It was only in 2016 to early 2018 that the rule was in effect in most of the state. But the upshot is that when the rule was in effect, 3,000 people in Allegheny County or thereabouts were kicked off of benefits without any proven evidence that this was actually helping people get into the workforce.
So there would be tighter work requirements for so-called able-bodied SNAP recipients between 18 and 49 years old with no minor children. What is going to change there?
What's going to change if the rule takes effect in April, as the Trump administration plans, is that people in that category, able-bodied, without dependents, and between 18 and 49, will be subject to time limits. They'll be kicked off of food stamps after 3 months unless they can prove that they are working 80 hours a month. Now, a lot of people work 80 hours a month, but have difficulty proving it. The paperwork is complicated. The rules about what constitutes a work-related activity are complicated. And proving whether or not you're able-bodied is complicated as well.
Is it specifically defined what is meant by able-bodied?
There are definitions in the federal law and there are definitions in the state procedures, but these are not things that are obvious to anyone. And a person, for instance, with a learning disability who has always struggled in school and struggled in the workforce may not be able to get a traditional job the way that you and I might think of going to answer an ad or a help wanted offer. People in that situation often will have a very difficult time demonstrating to the state that they are medically unable to work. That's the term of art in the regulations.
So the reasoning for it is strictly saving money or what?
The reasoning is fundamentally unreasonable. The money that would be allegedly saved is also money that comes out of consumer spending in the economy. When you kick people off of food stamps, they have less money to spend at the grocery store, and that hurts people who work as truck drivers for grocery stores and cashiers and owners of grocery stores. All of those downstream effects are ignored by this regulation. It supposedly saves money, but taxpayers will spend a lot more at the state level making every Department of Human Services caseworker go through the paperwork about whether everybody is able-bodied or not and whether people are working 80 hours a month or 79 hours a month. Because if you work 80, you stay on food stamps, and if you work 79, you're kicked off of food stamps.
This rule is expected to change food stamp eligibility for 700,000 Americans, including 90,000 Pennsylvanians. Ken, from your vantage point with Just Harvest, how many people in the Pittsburgh area lose out here?
The estimates that we have seen suggest that it's about 1,800 to 2,000 people here in Allegheny County. It was about 3,000 people that lost their food stamp benefits during the time that that the rule was last in effect.
Who are they? What are their lives like?
They are some of the most difficult to employ folks in the community. What we saw during the time that the rule was in effect was that lots of people who were trying to start a small business, lots of people in the gig economy, people who were working a little bit, people who were trying to find full-time work but only working part-time, were the kinds of folks who were getting kicked off. People who were clearly medically unable to work but couldn't get that paperwork together to demonstrate that to the department's satisfaction were the kinds of folks who are being kicked off.
Our guest on the Confluence is Ken Riegel, Executive Director of Just Harvest. We're talking about proposed changes by the Trump administration to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits. Ken, for those less familiar with the program, what sort of assistance does SNAP cover?
So food stamps, or SNAP as it's officially called now, provides people with basic money to go to the grocery store and shop for food through a debit card-like system called electronic benefit transfer. And if you jump through all the necessary hoops and qualify for those benefits, the average person receives about $120 a month worth of food benefits. They can't be spent on toilet paper and toothpaste. They can only be spent on foodstuffs and not prepared foods.
And for little ones, I don't believe it covers, say, diapers or formula?
Well, it does cover formula, but not diapers.
Okay. Federal officials have argued that a stricter work requirement would provide, quote, assistance through difficult times, not lifelong dependency. Do you think lawmakers have a clear understanding of what that means to people who do rely on the program?
The people formulating this regulation in the Trump administration's U.S. Department of Agriculture fundamentally either don't understand or ignore the reality. If you Google the phrase work requirements don't work, you'll see a body of research that shows that these things are ineffective in getting people out of poverty, in getting people into the workforce, that all they do is kick people off of benefits. They are based on a malicious and incorrect stereotype of low-income people as lazy and undeserving, and we as citizens should demand better.
On the flip side, critics say this effectively punishes people who may want to find work but can't find anything. And it's more likely to hurt veterans, people who are recently incarcerated, or others truly in need. Is that a fair summary?
It affects people who turn 18 years old and are not equipped to be in the workforce. It affects people who whose children turn 18 years old and suddenly they are now an adult without dependents. It affects people who are trying mightily to jump through all the necessary hoops to find work, to make a living, and are unsuccessful in that endeavor. And it says to those people, you're lazy, you're undeserving, you're evil, you don't deserve the support of your neighbors in keeping food on the table.
This rule is to go into effect April 1st of next year unless it's stopped by the courts or Congress. How will this affect your work at Just Harvest?
Well, the first thing that we'll be doing to try to prevent this from going into effect is pushing the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services to challenge this action in court. We believe that there are substantial violations of the law of the food stamp laws that constitute overreach in this regulation. So we think that that's strategy number one. If the rule were to go into effect, similar to what we did in 2016 to 18, we'll be working with individual clients to help certify them as medically unfit to work, to help them demonstrate if they are in a work-related activity, to demonstrate that to the department's satisfaction so that they can preserve their benefits.
Ken Riegel is the executive director of the Southside-based anti-hunger group Just Harvest. Ken, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh City Council is expected to take a final vote today on legislation that would, among other things, acknowledge racism as a public health crisis in Pittsburgh. Joining us to talk about the legislation and how racism impacts healthcare is Dara Mendez, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. Welcome to The Confluence.
Good morning.
And Damia Horsley is the maternal and child health program coordinator at Healthy Start. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This legislation comes after the Gender Equity Commission released a report that showed significant inequality for Black women in Pittsburgh. What are some of the specifics that you found in the report that are important to note?
So among other things, the report showed that Black women were more likely to be unemployed and to live in poverty than a Black women in any other comparable state or city in the United States. And that was really concerning. But more than that, and something that we already knew, is that Black women were more likely to suffer from health issues than other women in similar cities, and Black babies as well.
Mm-hmm. Dara, what was your take from that report?
Yeah, just to add to that, similarly, there were... That particular report showed racial disparities in infant mortality, maternal mortality, which are some of the core issues that we work on in addition to morbidity. Mm-hmm. And within the context of that report, I think it elevated once again the comparison with other cities, like cities, and the fact that here in Pittsburgh we see this disparity at a much more greater sort of disparity in volume. I think the other core issue that we also wanted to highlight, we wrote a response in as it related to that report. So Black women and femmes who have been conducting work within this area in Pittsburgh for decades combined were also seeing disparities and conducting work specifically around this issue. And so in our response to that report and some of the coverage related to that report, really wanted to highlight the work that had been done and to also articulate that in order to address these disparities, that the women who are most impacted needed to be centered in not only the reporting of that work, but also the solutions that needed to be developed.
Why is the legislation coming now? Are the disparities worsening, or is it just more attention is being paid now?
We really believe that the report brought a lot of attention to those disparities that already existed. So again, these are issues that we already knew that were going on within the population of women and Black women and femmes that work in this area. But that report really highlighted them and brought some attention to those issues.
Yeah.
Dara?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is not, so racism as a public health issue is not a new conversation within the realm of public health. This is something that has been brought to the forefront within this field for over decades. And so there has been shown research around not only the impact of racism on the individual level, but also institutional level and its implications for health and well-being. And so this is something that has been elevated in the field for quite some time. The report, once again, does elevate this local conversation, but as we mentioned, this work has been happening for a while.
How do you define public health crisis?
So there is no, I would say, epidemiologic definition of public health crisis. We can think of an epidemic, or we can think of issues that have an impact on populations and over time. So when thinking about racism as a public health issue or public health crisis, we know that this is not a one-time incident, that there are institutional structural elements that have an impact on health over history and also have current effects as well.
What are some of the tangible impacts racism has on our neighbors, our residents of the city, on their health?
I think that we see not only locally but statewide that that racism has had an impact on infant mortality and maternal mortality and health overall. So just recently, Dr. Art James, he is a nationally recognized OBGYN and pediatrician, did a presentation and really highlighted the gap in infant mortality in Pennsylvania. And so currently, well, according to 2016 data, the infant mortality rate for whites was 14.9, but the infant mortality for whites was 4.6. And he highlighted that it hasn't been since 1973 to 75, that we've seen an infant mortality rate for whites that looks like what we saw for blacks in 2016. And if that trend continues, what that means is that black babies will have to wait until 2052 or 2056 to see similar infant mortality rates for that we see for whites now.
The numbers you cite, those are state numbers?
Those are state numbers.
Now, I understand Allegheny County, I believe it was from the same report or a similar report, the infant mortality rate, black babies, white babies, 4.5 times.
Yes.
Here in Allegheny. Yes, and this has been an
disparity.
Ongoing issue, hasn't it, for decades?
It has. And what we really see in Pittsburgh is we see the legacy of redlining. So the areas where we see chronic disease and poor birth outcomes, as well as disinvestment and just overall disparities, follows the redlining maps of the 1930s. So we see this, we can see a direct link to racism in health outcomes in Pittsburgh.
Dara, the disparities in terms of health don't end when it comes to, they're beyond infant mortality rate, are they not?
Correct.
So give us an idea of where they also manifest themselves in terms of health.
So there are disparities in infant mortality and maternal mortality, but also morbidity. So we can think about pregnancy-related hypertension, preterm birth, and other chronic illnesses as key in understanding infant and maternal outcomes. But also outside of that, we see disparities in cancer. We see disparities in other chronic disease such as diabetes, obesity. So there are other health outcomes in which this manifests. Mm-hmm. But when we're thinking about social determinants and structural determinants, that the reason for those disparities are developed as a result of the root causes. So if we can think about structural institutional racism affecting neighborhood structures, as Damia pointed out, redlining being one example, if we can think about it in terms of the work environment, also thinking about it in terms of access to resources, whether that's healthcare, transportation, that those inequalities or inequities have an impact on health as well.
Our guests on The Confluence are Damia Horsley from Healthy Start and Dara Mendez from the Pitt Graduate School of Public Health. We're talking about racism as a public health crisis. One of the root causes, is it just access to proper health care? Is that one of the root causes of how some of these health disparities manifest themselves?
Access to health care is important, so I don't want to minimize the fact that access to healthcare has an impact on not only, you know, the outcomes that we talked about, maternal and infant outcomes, mm-hmm. but also other chronic illnesses. But we also have to understand that our interactions with the healthcare system are a small portion of you know, the things that make up the sort of totality of our health. So we may interact with the healthcare system and may have, you know, core issues not only with access, but if we have access, what is that treatment like? So we, you know, there's a large body of work around medical maltreatment and racial bias within the healthcare setting. So we know that has an impact on health outcomes. But even beyond healthcare, there are core elements that impact people's daily lives that go outside of healthcare. Some of the things that I mentioned as it relates to neighborhood structure, as it relates to opportunity, educational opportunity, economic opportunity as well.
To me, Healthy Start obviously works directly with the community. What have people told you, your colleagues, that they want to change?
I would say Healthy Start was really created in order to address infant and maternal mortality, and specifically disparities in infant and maternal mortality. So while I don't work directly with with clients, we do know that one of the major issues is that mothers don't feel listened to. So one of the things that we really work to do at Healthy Start is highlight the experiences of mothers and our participants as the experts in their experience and what they need in order to address their health and health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left. Dara, I know you testified at a post-agenda session by City Council, and Demia, your boss was also spoke at that. What was the message, briefly, that each of you wanted to deliver?
Dara? Absolutely. I'll let Demia start. So there are some core recommendations that Jada, CEO, cited, and then I can add to that.
Okay.
So as I mentioned, we really try to highlight the voice of our participants as the experts in their experience. And so our message really centered around the importance of full and direct participation of members of groups that are most impacted in developing specifically public, in this context, public health legislation. We really formed our message around the phrase, nothing about us without us. So not formulating programming or legislation without explicit input from those who are most impacted. We also cautioned against any public health related legislation that doesn't include public health leadership and holistic focus on social determinants of health, as Dara had mentioned. And then also cautioning against any public health related legislation that doesn't explicitly include and hold accountable our health systems.
Mm-hmm. Dara, briefly?
Yeah, briefly. So one of the things that I mentioned is that these pieces of legislation, there are three core components, are a start to naming racism, but there are critical elements in moving forward. Demia mentioned, you know, full participation from community, but also transparency. So there is a fund that will be developed as well as a leadership forum. So ensuring that any funds or any processes moving forward and strategies related to that, that there's full transparency and community input and participation and co-leadership. The other core element that I highlighted was to ensure that we're talking about intersectionality, which means that we're talking about how racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, patriarchy, all of those things emerge to create adverse outcomes for Black women in particular, Black women and femmes, and so that we can't talk about racism alone without talking about these other core elements as well.
Okay, and finally, in a couple of sentences each, so our elected leaders are taking a step, but what are the next steps beyond this, whether it's our elected leaders or the community as a whole addressing these disparities, briefly? Tamia.
I think the next and most important step is really taking into consideration these recommendations that we put forth and making sure that community voices are heard and that community has an input in how this unfolds and develops.
Dara?
I agree. I think ensuring that the recommendations that we have given, there were three panels that day, as well as a community forum. There were quite a number of recommendations given to the council. So I think all of those need to be considered in tandem.
And a reminder, Pittsburgh Council is expected to vote today on the legislation that acknowledges racism as a public health crisis. Dara Mendez, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health, and Demia Horsley is the maternal and child health program coordinator at Healthy Start. Thanks to both of you for making the time.
Thank you for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow at this time, we will provide live NPR coverage of the House floor debate on the articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. Thursday on The Confluence, our year-in-review program, as we explore top stories in public
politics, government, development, health, education, and the arts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Julia Zenkovic. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.